This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right by Ann Coulter. Read for you by the author.
Political debate in this country is insufferable. Whether conducted in Congress, on the political talk shows, or played out at dinners and cocktail parties, politics is a nasty sport. At the risk of giving away the ending, it's all liberals' fault. As there is less to dispute, liberals have become more bitter and angry. The Soviet threat has been vaporized. Women are not prevented from doing even the things they should be, and the gravest danger facing most black Americans today is the risk of being patronized to death. And yet still, somehow, Tom DeLay, Republican congressman from Texas, poses a monumental threat to democracy as we know it. The left expresses disagreement with DeLay's governing philosophy by calling him the meanest man in Congress, dangerous, the hammer, the exterminator, and the Torquemada of Texas. For his evident belief in a higher being, DeLay is compared to savage murderers and genocidal lunatics on the pages of the New York Times. Quote, "History teaches that when religion is injected into politics, the Crusades, Henry VIII, Salem, Father Coughlin, Hitler, Kosovo, disaster follows." Liberals dispute slight reductions in the marginal tax rates as if they are trying to prevent Charles Manson from slaughtering baby seals. Progress cannot be made on serious issues because one side is making arguments and the other side is throwing eggs, both figuratively and literally. Prevarication and denigration are the hallmarks of liberal argument. Logic is not their métier. Blind religious faith is. The liberal catechism includes a hatred of Christians, guns, the profit motive, and political speech, and an infatuation with abortion, the environment, and race discrimination, or in the favored parlance of liberals, affirmative action. Heresy on any of these subjects is, well, heresy. The most crazed religious fanatic argues in more calm and reasoned tones than liberals responding to statistics on concealed carry permits. Perhaps if conservatives had had total control over every major means of news dissemination for a quarter century, they would have forgotten how to debate too, and would just call liberals stupid and mean. But that's an alternative universe. In this universe, the public square is wall-to-wall liberal propaganda. Americans wake up in the morning to America's sweetheart, the Today Show's Katie Couric, berating Arlen Specter about Anita Hill 10 years after the hearings, or haranguing Charlton Heston on the need for gun control to stop school shootings. We read letters to the editor of the New York Times from pathetic little parakeet males and grim, quivering, angry women on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, hoping to be chosen as that day's purveyor of hate. These letters are about one step above Tiger Beat magazine in intellectual engagement. They are never responsive. They never include clever reposts or attacks. They merely restate the position of the Times with greater venom. I was reminded by your editorial that Bush wasn't even your average politically aware Yalie. He was too busy branding freshmen at his fraternity house. In the evening, CBS anchor Dan Rather can be found falsely accusing Republicans of all manner of malfeasance, or remarking that a president who has been impeached, disbarred, and held in contempt for his lies is an honest man. Diane Sawyer pronounces that the American people are yawning at the news that the president was engaging in sodomy with a cigar and oral anal sex with a White House intern. Hollywood movies preach about kind-hearted abortionists, Nazi priests, rich preppy Republican bigots, and the dark night of fascism under Senator Joe McCarthy. We read national magazines that pretend to be reasonable while seething with the impotent violence of women. We wade through preposterous news stories on Enron, global warming, Tawana Brawley, plastic guns, the melting of the North Pole, the meaning of the word is, until you can't keep up with the wave of lies. It's like being in an earthquake listening to all the gibberish. When arguments are premised on lies, there is no foundation for debate. You end up conceding half the lies simply to focus on the lies of Holocaust denial proportions. The spirit of the First Amendment has been effectively repealed for conservative speech by a censorious accusatory mob. Truth cannot prevail because whole categories of thought are deemed hate crimes. For a fleeting moment after the September 11 attack on America, all partisan wrangling stopped dead. The country was infused with patriotism and amazingly unified. The attack on America was such a colossal jolt, liberals even abandoned their endless pursuit of producing some method of counting the ballots in Florida that would have made Al Gore president. Liberal sneers about President Bush's intelligence suddenly abated, at first for reasons of decorum, but then because of the indisputable fact that Bush was a magnificent leader. In a moment of crisis, the truth overcame liberal naysaying. After having demeaned President Bush as a lightweight frat boy, hopelessly ignorant of foreign policy, even Democrats were overcome with relief that Al Gore was not the president. The bipartisan love fest lasted precisely 3 weeks. That was all the New York Times could endure. Impatient with the national mood of patriotism, liberals returned to their infernal griping about George W. Bush, or half a commander-in-chief, as he was called in the headline of a lead New York Times editorial on November 5, 2001. From that moment on, the left's primary contribution to the war effort was to complain. They complained about the detention of terror suspects. They complained we were going to lose the war. They complained about military tribunals for terrorists. They complained about the Bush administration's failure to solve the anthrax cases instantly. They complained about monitoring terrorist jailhouse conversations. They complained about the war taking too long. They complained about a trial for John Walker. They complained about non-existent ethnic profiling at airports. They complained about the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo. And they complained about Bush's access of evil speech. It must have been galling that no one in America cared. Eventually, the New York Times gave up harping about Bush's handling of the war and turned its full attention to attacking Enron. Here, the country had finally given liberals a war against fundamentalism, and they didn't want to fight it. Indeed, the attack on America by fanatical Muslims had finally provided liberals with a religion they could respect. Heretofore, liberals deemed voluntary student prayers at high school football games a direct assault on the Constitution. But it was of urgent importance that Islamic terrorists being held in Guantanamo be free to practice their religion. This, despite the fact that we had been repeatedly instructed that the terrorists were not practicing true Islam. Less than 3 months after Islamic terrorists slaughtered thousands of Americans, ABC's 2020 ran a major report titled, "Abortion Clinics in U.S. Targeted by Religious Terrorists." As Jamie Floyd reported, "Since September 11th, the word terrorist has come to mean someone who is radical, Islamic, and foreign. But many believe we have as much to fear from a homegrown group of anti-abortion crusaders." New York Times columnist Frank Rich demanded that Ashcroft stop monkeying around with Muslim terrorists and concentrate on anti-abortion extremists. Rich claimed that only pure political malice could explain Attorney General Ashcroft's refusal to meet with Planned Parenthood while purporting to investigate terrorism. Rarely had the great divide in the country been so manifest. Liberals hate America, they hate flag wavers, they hate abortion opponents, they hate all religions except Islam post-9/11. Even Islamic terrorists don't hate America like liberals do. They don't have the energy. If they had that much energy, they'd have indoor plumbing by now. Long before the war, conservatives had a vague sense that liberals didn't much like them. Consider that a president, whom liberals themselves called, quote, indefensible, outrageous, unforgivable, and shameless, had staved off removal from office merely by calling his opponents right-wing Republicans. It was apparent then that we were dealing with a species of primitive religious hatred. Clinton's lies under oath in a judicial proceeding were such a shock to the legal system that just weeks before every Senate Democrat would vote to keep him in office, the entire Supreme Court boycotted Clinton's State of the Union address. One of many historical firsts in the Clinton years. That stunning rebuke was meaningless. Liberals were impervious to any logic beyond Clinton's mantra that his opponents were right-wing Republicans. Professional Democrats have Clintonized the entire party, and they will destroy anyone who stands in their way. All that matters to them is power. They believe their moral superiority allows them to do things that would appall ordinary people. In May 2001, former Clinton strategists James Carville and Paul Begala released a battle plan for the Democrats on the op-ed page of the New York Times. Their central piece of advice was for Democrats to start calling President George Bush names. First, they said, liberals must, quote, call a radical. Other proposals included calling Bush dangerous and uncompassionate. Quote, Mr. Bush's agenda is neither compassionate nor conservative. It's radical and it's dangerous and the Democrats should say so. That's it. That's the new plan. It's the same as the old plan. Call Republicans names. Meanwhile, the left's political Tourette syndrome has gone completely unremarked upon. All parties to the debate carry on as if it's totally normal for two of the most famous Democratic consultants to be recommending name-calling as political strategy. Clinton seemed to be making a good argument against impeachment by perseverating about a right-wing conspiracy out to get him. An annoyingly typical Republican response to liberal hate speech is to attack one's friends in order to appease one's enemies. Democrats still hate the Republican appeasers. They just hate them a little less. And when it comes time for the left to tear down the conciliators, these Republican moderates won't have many friends left willing to defend them. As Winston Churchill said, appeasement reflects the hope that the crocodile will eat you last. With some portion of, admittedly craven Republicans, casually acknowledging the liberal premise that conservatives are mean and hateful, the left is emboldened to carry on with ever greater insolence. When Senator Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party, he explained his defection by saying he was against slavery, supported the Union side in the Civil War, and opposed McCarthyism. He did concede that his decision to leave the Republican Party was, perhaps, of smaller consequence. But then he continued in the same ludicrous vein, saying he had joined the party believing it stood for moderation and tolerance. Alas, he said, increasingly I find myself in disagreement with my party. Back in the party's halcyon days, when Jeffords presumably did not find himself in disagreement, he opposed Reagan's tax cut, supported the elder Bush's tax hike, supported Clinton's tax hike, and opposed the younger Bush's tax cut. The big tent may accommodate a lot of kooks, but if the Republican Party doesn't stand for tax cuts, it is nothing but a random assemblage of people, tax cutters, tax gougers, whatever. Jeffords was a big fan of Hillary Clinton's socialist healthcare plan, which was such an unprecedented federal takeover of private industry that even the Democrats finally blanched. He voted against Clinton's impeachment and against Clarence Thomas's confirmation. Needless to say, he has always been pro-abortion. So maybe the problem wasn't the Republicans' sudden lack of tolerance and moderation, but Jeffords' slow realization that he had always been in disagreement with his party. Often short on details, the classic liberal response to a principled conservative argument is to accuse Republicans of planning a second Holocaust. No matter how inured one becomes to liberal hate speech, the regularity with which Republicans are compared to Nazis still astonishes. One would almost think fascist dictatorial regimes demanding governmental control of the major means of production were an immoderate extension of efforts to trim the income tax. Weeks before the Starr report was released, Keith Olbermann, host of The Big Show on MSNBC, said, quote, "It finally dawned on me that the person Ken Starr has reminded me of facially all this time was Heinrich Himmler, including the glasses." In an upbeat message delivered on British TV on Christmas Day, 1994, Jesse Jackson compared conservatives in both the U.S. and Great Britain to Nazis. Quote, "In South Africa, the status quo was called racism. We rebelled against it. In Germany, it was called fascism. Now in Britain and the U.S., it is called conservatism." The New York Times did not report the speech. Speaking to the Black and Puerto Rican Legislative Caucus Forum at the Capitol, Representatives Charles Rangel and Major Owens, both Democrats of New York, said the Republicans' contract with America was as bad as Hitler's Germany. "When I compare this to what happened in Germany," Rangel said, "I hope that you will see the similarities to what is happening to us." Owens was more explicit. "These are people who are practicing genocide with a smile. They're worse than Hitler." Representative and erstwhile Democratic presidential candidate Patricia Schroeder, Democrat of Colorado, accused opponents to Henry Foster, Clinton's nominee for Surgeon General, of, quote, "goose-stepping over women's rights," and informed the League of Women Voters that Rush Limbaugh's listeners are the ones who are goose-stepping. When not secretly planning a second Holocaust, Republicans seem to busy themselves with ethnic cleansing, race-baiting, and lynchings, also plotting to bring back slavery. The liberal trope of associating Republicans with slavery is a daring smear inasmuch as the Republican Party was formed for the express purpose of opposing slavery. It was the Democratic Party that defended slavery. The Whigs, whence the Republican Party emerged, was pro-choice on the slavery issue. Harvard law professor Alan Dershowitz described Florida's practice of not allowing convicted felons to vote as ethnically cleansing the voting lists. Representative Kwesi Mufume, Democrat of Maryland, said the Republicans' plan to cut funding for 28 useless House caucuses constituted ethnic and philosophical cleansing. Striking an especially high note in the 2000 presidential campaign, Vice President Al Gore aggressively implied that Bush's Supreme Court nominees would bring back slavery. Not only that, but Justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas were already hard at work on the Republicans' pro-slavery initiative. In numerous campaign speeches, Gore said Bush's pledge to appoint strict constructionists to the court, such as Scalia and Thomas, reminded him of the strictly constructionist meaning that was applied when the Constitution was written, and how some people were considered three-fifths of a human being. If you were one of the swing voters waiting to see which of the candidates supported slavery, at least Gore had cleared up the confusion. The man was actually demagoguing slavery. At the risk of seeming overly legalistic, Bush, Scalia, and Thomas do not subscribe to a legal philosophy that would bring back slavery. Strict constructionism means only that judges should interpret laws rather than write them. It has nothing to do with slavery. Moreover, Gore's implication that it would have been nicer if slaves had counted as full persons in the Constitution is the pro-slavery position. Since the three-fifths clause refers only to congressional apportionment, counting slaves as full persons would have given the slaveholding South more votes in Congress. Real hate speech does not have to be flagged and labeled. It speaks for itself. If a person makes an argument that is, in fact, racist, anti-Semitic, sexist, looksist, whatever, that fact ought to be self-evident. Simply restating the argument would expose the wily bigot, if bigotry it is, without a big warning label screaming racist, sexist, homophobic. A false argument should be refuted, not named. That's the basic idea behind freedom of speech. Arguments by demonization rather than truth and light can be presumed to be fraudulent. But ad hominem attack is the liberals' idea of political debate. They self-consciously hold themselves outside the argument and make snippy personal comments about anyone who is actually talking about something. The Republican's motives are analyzed, his intelligence critiqued, his personal life unearthed. If it were true that conservatives were racist, sexist, homophobic, fascist, stupid, inflexible, angry, and self-righteous, shouldn't their arguments be easy to deconstruct? Someone who is making a point out of anger, ideology, inflexibility, or resentment would presumably construct a flimsy argument. So why can't the argument itself be dismembered rather than the speaker's personal style or hidden motives? Why the evasions? It ought to raise eyebrows that no one can ever seem to get a real live quote from a Republican demonstrating all this hate evident to New York Times editors. If conservatives actually were seething with such boundless hatreds, one might expect it to bubble over into their public discourse every once in a while. Like what Monica Lewinsky testified to in her scintillating concluding statement to the grand jury, "I hate Linda Tripp." Would that have been deemed cute if Tripp had said it? Gore campaign manager Donna Brazile called Colin Powell an Uncle Tom. Seemingly unaware of her boss's race, she vowed that she would not let the white boys win in this election. Brazile said Colin Powell and Republican Congressman J.C. Watts have no love and no joy, and would rather take pictures with black children than feed them. Democratic strategist Peter Fenn defended Brazile, saying she was trying to be inclusive. Colin Powell failed to appreciate the inclusiveness, saying he was disappointed and offended by Brazil's comments. J.C. Watts called her inclusive statements racist. Gore, striving for inclusiveness, refused to apologize to Powell or Watts. Meanwhile, when he was still co-host of The Today Show on NBC, Bryant Gumbel casually asked J.C. Watts whether it bothered him to be associated with, quote, conservative extremists who are historically insensitive to minority concerns. This is in contrast to Democrats, who are inclusive. After Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas wrote an opinion contrary to the clearly expressed position of the New York Times editorial page, the Times responded with an editorial on Thomas titled, "The Youngest, Cruelest Justice." That was actually the headline on a lead editorial in the newspaper of record. Thomas is not engaged on the substance of his judicial philosophy. He is called a colored lawn jockey for conservative white interests, race traitor, black snake, chicken and biscuit-eating Uncle Tom, house Negro and handkerchief head, Benedict Arnold and Judas Iscariot. If liberals have a principled argument against Justice Thomas, they're not telling, but they really don't like him. Thus they malign Thomas in terms that would constitute a hate crime if it came from anyone but a liberal. What liberals mean by goose-stepping, or ethnic cleansing, is generally something along the lines of eliminating taxpayer funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. But they can't say that, or people would realize they're crazy. So instead, they accuse Republicans of speaking in code words. This is one of the most enraging twists on the left's refusal to debate. Since authentically racist behavior would be apparent on its face, the concept of code words allows liberals to call anyone a racist. The basic idea is that the untrained masses cannot be expected to comprehend a confusing world on their own, so the liberal clergy will translate for them. In a 1994 New York Times editorial on Newt Gingrich, the pious gray lady explained, "Welcome to Speaker Gingrich's retro world. Mr. Gingrich communicates in the venerable code words of Barry Goldwater and George Wallace." The code words, of course, originally had much to do with race. Senator Goldwater and Governor Wallace bandied them, after all, in a battle for Deep South electoral votes. But this race-based, anger-charged politics mutated in Mr. Gingrich and some others of his generation into a more generalized moral authoritarianism. New York Magazine's Jacob Weisberg and the Reverend Jesse Jackson also noticed the amazing similarities between Gingrich and George Wallace. Liberals don't even have original ideas when they call Republicans names. If Gingrich's legislative plan had, in fact, included provisions to resegregate the schools, wouldn't someone have noticed? Instead, liberals are left to make vague allegations about an apocryphal secret code calculated to inflame pogrom-oriented Americans. One reporter on Inside Washington discerned the Republican desire to murder gays in the air. It's sort of complicated, but involves a three-step process. Discussing the murder of Matthew Shepard, the gay man brutally killed by two thugs in Wyoming, Deborah Mathis of Gannett News Service explained how conservative Republicans were responsible for Shepard's death. She said, "The Christian right per se and some particular members on Capitol Hill have helped inflame the air so that the air that these people breathed that night was filled with the idea that somehow gays are different, and not only are they different in that difference, but they're bad, and not only are they bad, they are evil, and therefore can be destroyed." The next step to that, it's a three-step process, and they certainly weren't part of any plan to do that, but again, what air are they breathing now? It's the air filled with that hate. I mentioned Trent Lott, Jesse Helms, and Dick Armey particularly, the Christian Coalition, the Family Research Council, and the Concerned Women for America. It's interesting that Mathis could remember the names of the destroyers with some precision, but the three-step process became rather vague between step one and step three. Without the second and third steps, the part where Republicans start hectoring the populace that gays, quote, are evil and therefore can be destroyed, the first step doesn't amount to much. Aren't gays different? Because if gays aren't different, then heterosexuals are different, and Republicans have a lot more murders to answer for than Matthew Shepard's. If anyone talks in code, it is not the people who need the internet and talk radio merely to communicate with one another. Only total hegemonic control of all major means of news dissemination in America could possibly give rise to the insane pig Latin patois of the left. Conservatives can't even pin down liberals on the word abortion. That's a choice, not school choice or pension plan choice or arts funding choice. Choice refers to one lone medical procedure that will never cross the lips of a liberal, abortion. This would be on the order of gun rights activists refusing to use the word gun. And if abortion is unspeakable, baby is actually punishable. Funnily, you never hear a pregnant woman say, "Put your ear to my stomach and listen to your little fetus sister," or, "I felt the fetus move today." Race discrimination tends to attract the most preposterous Orwellian circumlocutions, such as equal opportunity and affirmative action. Even if the race discrimination is designed to discriminate in favor of historic victims amply deserving of preferential treatment, it is still discrimination. But liberals would sooner say the Lord's Prayer in a public school than utter the words race discrimination to describe race discrimination. Also in the English to Liberal dictionary, liberal is translated as moderate or centrist. And conservative is far-right wing, or ultra-conservative. Adjectives like moderate and far-right wing are a crucial part of the journalistic reward system for politicians. It is how pompously boring newspapers and magazines hurl epithets at politicians they don't like and suck up to the ones they do. In the entire New York Times archives on LexisNexis, there are 109 items using the phrase far-right wing, but only 18 items that use far-left wing. There are 149 uses of ultra-conservative, but only 59 uses of ultra-liberal. 19 uses of conservative extremist, but only 8 uses of liberal extremist. Consider the utter vacuousness of the phrase moderate Republican. Moderate ought to mean right in the middle, not too liberal and not too conservative. So why not just say Republican? In the New York Times archives, moderate Republican has been used 168 times. There have been only 11 sightings of a liberal Republican. In a typical formulation, the Times explained in an editorial that President Bush planned to, quote, eke out majorities by wooing conservative Democrats to his side, even if that might alienate some moderate Republicans. When a moderate Republican is so liberal that he is less likely to support a Republican president than some Democrats, doesn't that finally make him a liberal? Liberals claim conservatives use code words, and as proof, they babble about vague, ephemeral concepts. A metaphor, proxies, a three-step process, indistinct feelings in the air. Meanwhile, conservatives can produce a chart of word-to-word translations from liberal code. Moderate equals liberal. Far right-wing equals conservative. Centrist equals 95 ADA rating. Choice equals abortion. Affirmative action equals race discrimination. Even the phrase code word is a code word for liberals lying about Republicans. Liberals can't just come out and say they want to take more of our money, kill babies, and discriminate on the basis of race. So instead, they compare Republicans to George Wallace, a Democrat. Had enough of the love? We're still not done because Republicans are also dumb and ugly. If Republicans are so stupid and poorly dressed, it's hard to understand why Democrats haven't been able to get as much as 50% of the country to vote for them in any national election for the last 25 years. But on CNN's Capital Gang on July 24, 1999, Margaret Carlson analyzed a Republican bill to cut taxes, saying, "I mean, the only thing that could explain this love of tax cuts is a lowered IQ." Writing in the Washington Post, columnist Richard Cohen made one of his typically incisive points, explaining that the Republican Party is, quote, dumb as a post. In case the nuance of Cohen's logic was lost, he continued, saying the Republican Party is, quote, defined by a hostility toward minorities, all sorts of minorities, and by a craven cowardice on the part of its more moderate members. The truth of the matter is that the party is having a crack-up. If it were a person, it would be medicated. Howell Raines, former editorial page editor of the New York Times, who covered the Reagan White House with the Times' trademark objectivity, asserted that, quote, Reagan couldn't tie his shoes if his life depended on it. And still, somehow, he won the Cold War. Al Gore told Virginia voters at a campaign rally that they should re-elect Virginia Senator Chuck Robb because his opponent, Oliver North, was supported by, quote, the extreme right wing, the extra chromosome right wing. The presence of an extra chromosome is the birth defect that creates Down syndrome. The Washington Post famously reported, as hard fact, that the followers of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson are largely poor, uneducated, and easy to command. Paula Jones was attacked by Newsweek's Evan Thomas as, quote, some sleazy woman with big hair coming out of the trailer parks. Aren't these the same people constantly demanding campus speech codes and an end to intolerance and hate speech so that no one's feelings get hurt? More than any of their other hate speech, the left's attacks on women for being ugly tell you everything. There is nothing so irredeemably cruel as an attack on a woman for her looks. Attacking a female for being ugly is a hideous thing, always inherently vicious. So which women are constantly being called ugly? Is it Maxine Waters, Chelsea Clinton, Janet Reno, or Madeleine Albright? No, none of these. Only conservative women have their looks held up to ridicule because only liberals would be so malevolent. A blind man in America would think the ugliest women ever to darken the planet are Paula Jones, Linda Tripp, and Katherine Harris. This from the party of Bella Abzug. Journalists have called Linda Tripp Barracudaville, smelling of gunpowder and garlic, ugly and evil, and Howard Stern in a fright wig. A snitch, and an ugly one at that. Syndicated columnist Julianne Malveaux referred to the ugly stick Tripp's been beaten with. There's something wrong with that woman, I'm serious. Actress Rose McGowan, Jawbreaker, told the Village Voice, "One thing that gives me pleasure is how ugly Tripp is. That's a karmic point. She deserves to be ugly." Another female columnist, Heather Malik, wrote, "Linda Tripp's the hulking dykey one, and book agent Lucianne Goldberg's her ugly sister." You will never appreciate the full savagery of the left until you get in their way. Wincing while others are attacked cannot compare. Imagine it is you, your wife, or your daughter they have set about to destroy. Then it won't matter if the authors of the hate speech are hideous, talentless wretches. You will hear the words calling you ugly and stupid, and you will believe, if only fleetingly, that the whole world sees you that way. Tripp ended up getting 2 facelifts and liposuction. Paula Jones got braces and a nose job. Even polished, wealthy, Harvard-educated, attractive women will be attacked for their looks if they get in the Democrats' way. When Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris was suddenly cast into the limelight because Al Gore was a sore loser, liberals promptly launched sadistic attacks on Harris's looks. A Boston Globe columnist wrote that unless Harris was planning to unwind at a drag bar after facing that phalanx of cameras Tuesday night, the grease paint she wore should be a federal offense. Al Gore advisor Mark Fabiani later explained the Democrats' attacks on Harris, glibly telling the New York Times, "We needed an enemy." He said attacking Harris was the right thing to do, and it worked. A central component of liberal hate speech is to make paranoid accusations based on their own neurotic impulses, such as calling Republicans angry, hate-filled, and mean. With no sense of self-irony, the left spitefully stereotypes Republicans as, among other loathsome characteristics, spiteful stereotypers. There may be just the tiniest element of projection and compulsion in all this. New York Times columnist Bob Herbert wrote an entire column on the Republicans' quote, mean strategy. As Herbert wearily explained, back in 1998, I offered the Republican Party some unsolicited advice. Give up the politics of meanness, I said. It's killing you. Alas, he concluded, the GOP never seems to learn. Liberals have compared conservatives to Down syndrome children, wished them dead of cholesterol-induced heart attacks, malevolently attacked women for their looks, called Clarence Thomas every racist name in the book, repeatedly stated that they, quote, hate Republicans, and now, in addition, they say Republicans are mean. After a rape victim spoke to the Republican National Convention in 1996, NBC's Tom Brokaw interviewed the speaker, posing this conundrum to her. The Republican Party is a party that is dominated by men, and this convention is dominated by men. Do you think before tonight they thought very much about what happens in America with rape? When Juanita Broderick went public with her claim that Bill Clinton had raped her, liberals wouldn't give her the time of day. Having flamboyantly accused Republicans of ignoring rape victims, liberals were later freed of the responsibility of having to pretend to care about rape themselves. In polls considered determinative on most matters by Democrats, 80% of respondents who heard Broderick's allegations thought they were true, 62%, or possibly true, 18%. Only 20% of respondents did not believe Broderick's assertion that a sitting United States president had committed rape. NBC had spent months investigating every aspect of Broderick's claim to rout any possible inconsistencies in her story. They found none. As is often the case with rape, no eyewitnesses were present for the actual rape, but as far as rape allegations go, Broderick was, at the very least, an extremely credible witness. Still, out of pure political calculation, NBC refused to run Lisa Meyer's interview with Broderick, describing her rape at the hands of Bill Clinton, until after the Senate had acquitted Clinton in his impeachment trial. Dan Rather did not mention Broderick's rape allegation one time on the CBS Evening News. He later explained that he had refused to report a plausible charge that the president was a rapist out of respect for Clinton's, quote, private sex life. Every single Senate Democrat and all but 5 House Democrats voted against the impeachment or removal of a president whom they knew was, more likely than not, a rapist. Those are cold, hard facts about how Democrats treated a credible rape charge. You can look them up. But according to the objective news reporting of Tom Brokaw, it's Republicans who don't care about rape. At the risk of helping liberals formulate more persuasive arguments, there are a few pointers that might help them upgrade from the overheated demagogic rhetoric of fanatical cult members. A little variation in epithets would at least create the illusion of having an argument. Nazi can be used properly in a sentence, but it tends to lose its sting when you call every Republican a Nazi. Stupid is also a fine word, but not for 25 Republican presidential candidates in a row. Using the same words to describe school vouchers as to characterize the Holocaust tends to leave the impression that you forgot your point. For the left, name-calling need bear no relationship to the facts. It is mere liturgy. There are many things Newt Gingrich could be called, for example, but stupid is not among them. However, the ritual imprecation must be uttered. Thus, the Tacoma, Washington News Tribune advised Gingrich, stop blurting out dumb stuff. San Francisco Examiner columnist Rob Moore sneered, there was Gingrich trying not to say something stupid again and rarely producing one barely decent line. Newt's landing gear, Moore said, never is fully locked. Using the popular quote someone who agrees with us technique, the New York Times repeated the remark of a California accountant who called Gingrich an idiot. He's just an idiot who plays to the media. An overture the media deftly had managed to resist. Gingrich's contract with America, the document that helped give Republicans control of Congress for the first time in half a century, was derided by one columnist as, quote, politically stupid. At least when right-wingers rant, there's a point. There are substantive arguments contained in conservative name-calling. One of Newt Gingrich's more pithy turns of phrase, for example, was to call Bob Dole tax collector for the welfare state. In addition to the welcome bipartisanship of attacking a member of his own party, and not from the left, Gingrich's attack conveys a meaningful concept. It succinctly degraded Dole's legislative function as consisting of nothing more than taking the taxpayers' money. Dole had failed to oppose behemoth government. He was a cog in the system that Democrats had created. All that in six words. By contrast, what does it mean to say Republicans are making war on the kids of this country? It must mean something because Democrats say it a lot. President Clinton said of Republicans in 1995, what they want to do is make war on the kids of this country. As First Lady Hillary Clinton said, if the wrong side wins this war on children, what will be lost is our notion of who we are as people and what we stand for as a society. It's not just the felon and his bride who talk this way. Democratic Representative Patricia Schroeder said, the first thing being thrown off the ship by Republicans are women and children. Democratic Representative John Lewis said of Republicans, they're coming for our children, they're coming for the poor, they're coming for the sick, elderly, and the disabled. Far be it from me to complain of colorful language, but these diatribes are utterly meaningless. They make no deeper point than, I hate you. The lack of specificity is the giveaway. Republicans could just as easily say the Democrats are making war on the kids of this country by condemning them to fatherless welfare-supported families, a life of tax gouging, a bankrupt Social Security fund, and huge federal deficits to repay. Republicans could call Democrats the wrong people, too. But Republicans have an actual point to make, so they don't say that. Republicans couldn't get away with political argument that sounds like Linda Blair and The Exorcist even if they wanted to. They don't own the mainstream media. As Freud observed, communal neuroses will always be much harder to detect because they define an entire group, not an individual distinct from the group. Perhaps if conservatives exercised hegemonic control over the media, they would be venom-spewing haters too. But they don't, so they aren't. Any Republican impropriety will be endlessly held up to scorn in a series of New York Times editorials, then picked up by the networks and featured on Good Morning America. Everything feminists claim about working women having to be smarter, better, and tougher than their male counterparts really is true of conservative Republicans. Usually the best that liberals can do in the way of Republican hate speech is to cite the funny jingles or hyperbole of talk radio hosts and explicit controversialists. Even here, the alleged hate speech is not likely to be honestly quoted. Rather, it is paraphrased, unfairly excerpted, summarized, or, if the liberal is the Washington Post's Howard Kurtz, invented out of whole cloth. It's true that Rush Limbaugh has identified a particular breed of feminists as feminazis. Not all feminists, just those who appear to prefer abortion, choice, to childbirth. Limbaugh is also an openly opinionated talk radio host, not the president, the vice president, a United States senator, editor of the New York Times, or a putatively objective TV news anchor. By contrast, hate is the coin of the realm for liberals at all levels of status, power, objectivity, and cachet. There is no difference between the fanatical ravings of a foaming-at-the-mouth James Carville and the utterances of a United States senator. Champion desecrator of life, Senator Teddy Kennedy, said this about a respected federal judge on the Senate floor. Robert Bork's America is a land in which women would be forced into back-alley abortions, blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters, rogue police could break down citizens' doors in midnight raids, school children could not be taught about evolution, writers and artists would be censored at the whim of government, and the doors of the federal courts would be shut on the fingers of millions of citizens for whom the judiciary is often the only protector of the individual rights that are the heart of our democracy. That's how the left expresses substantive disagreement with the legal philosophy of a sitting federal judge. Is it Hitler, or is it a former Yale professor? It can be categorically stated that no sitting Republican United States senator has ever accused an ideological opponent of anything along the lines of trying to bring back segregated lunch counters. Scurrilous attack ads from the Democratic National Committee are gleefully replayed by the major networks and pointedly endorsed. After the 2000 election, the Democrats ran a commercial falsely suggesting that President Bush was befouling our pure drinking water by putting, quote, more arsenic in it. This was a lie, but the deceptive commercials were replayed by TV news programs along with testimonials to their accuracy. The claim that Bush had effected a rollback of current policy was more misleading than some of Joe McCarthy's more outlandish assertions. Bush had merely delayed a prospective change to a 60-year standard governing arsenic in drinking water. This was evidently a matter of such burning urgency that the former president of the United States, Bill Clinton, had done nothing about it during 7 years and 300-odd days in office. It was not until 3 days before he left office that POTUS lowered the arsenic standard from 50 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion. Even Clinton's 11th-hour alteration in the standard was not to take effect until the year 2006. The DNC's demagogic, hateful television commercial showed a little girl asking, "May I please have some more arsenic in my water, Mommy?" The narrator then intoned, "George W. Bush tried to roll back protections against arsenic in drinking water." Except there was no rollback. CBS News reporter John Roberts played a clip of the inaccurate Democrat ad and then critically asked, "Democrats ask what happened to Mr. Bush's vaunted promise to change the tone in Washington and put an end to partisan sniping." NBC's Tim Russert followed his presentation of the outrageously misleading ad with the announcement, "There's nothing inaccurate in that ad." Despite the neurotic compulsion to attribute all liberal stunts to, quote, both sides, conservatives couldn't get away with nonsense like this even if they wanted to. It is a stunning reflection of the left's monopoly of the news that an opinionated partisan talk radio host is more accurate than television news programs. Assuming that in more than 10,000 hours of radio and television commentary, Rush Limbaugh had made a similarly exaggerated claim, I searched LexisNexis for the indignant news reports on Rush's alleged distortions. There are plenty of denunciations of Rush for being inaccurate, but it turns out liberals lie even when accusing conservatives of lying. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, hilariously dedicated to exposing the right-wing bias in the media and cold days in hell, had compiled an allegedly meticulously researched anti-Rush report. The Rush distortion that was the left's major expose, the contretemps to end all contretemps, the anti-Rush reporter's favorite bit from the meticulously researched FAIR report, was Rush's claim that after a California woman had been mauled to death by a mountain lion, a fund for her children had received about $9,000, and a fund for the orphaned lion cub, the lion was killed, set up by a bunch of animal rights activists had received $21,000. According to the meticulous research of FAIR, it was triumphantly proclaimed, there never was such a fund for the cub. The real story, one columnist proclaimed, had been explained on ABC's 2020. It was a great gotcha moment, except that, as usual, once you go to the trouble to look up the facts, it was a lie. Rush was right. There was a cub fund, and it had received more money than the orphaned children's fund. Indeed, every detail was exactly as Rush had said. Though Rush was among the first to report on the disparity in the funds for the lions versus the humans, eventually the story became the subject of dozens of news articles. Liberals constantly try to define every random nutcase in the country as right-wing, but no matter how many times liberals say it, Nazis and white supremacists, all six of them, are not right-wing. The Ku Klux Klan is not merely a somewhat more exuberant version of the Republican Party. If, as a matter of fact, one were itching to draw a correlation between white supremacist nuts and one of the two mainstream political parties, Democrats are manifestly the more obvious candidate for that distinction. With their infernal racial set-asides, racial quotas, and race norming, liberals share many of the Klan's premises. The Klan sees the world in terms of race and ethnicity. So do liberals. Indeed, liberals and white supremacists are the only people left in America who are neurotically obsessed with race. Conservatives champion a colorblind society. They don't even get to the first step with racists. Of course, one big difference between the Klan and liberals is that liberals have a lot more power. Though endlessly celebrated in sensational news reports, the random Nazi or Klan member is rare and comically unthreatening. Nazism is simply not a burgeoning phenomenon in America just now. Klan marches bring out more protesters than Klan members. But there are a lot of liberals. They are painfully self-righteous, they have fantastic hatreds, and they could not see the other fellow's position if you prodded them with white-hot pokers. They are United States senators, New York Times editors, news anchors, and TV personalities. And they are completely unhinged. Liberals thrive on the attractions of snobbery. Only when you appreciate the powerful driving force of snobbery in the liberals' worldview do all their preposterous, counterintuitive arguments make sense. They promote immoral, destructive behavior because they are snobs. They embrace criminals because they are snobs. They oppose tax cuts because they are snobs. They adore the environment because they are snobs. Every pernicious idea to come down the pike is instantly embraced by liberals to prove how powerful they are. Liberals hate society and want to bring it down to reinforce their sense of invincibility. Secure in the knowledge that their beachfront haciendas will still be standing when the smoke clears, they giddily fiddle with the little people's rules and morals. While the rich are insulated by their wealth from the societal disintegration they promote, the rest of us are protected from these Dionysian revolutionaries and their pet intellectual disenchantment only by our abiding belief in God. That's why religious people drive liberals nuts. Bourgeois morality allows people to have happy lives without fantastic wealth. In the 60s, affluent, pampered liberals capitulated to the groovy countercultural mores of their college-age children, embracing free love and rampant drug use. It was all harmless fun. They knew the kids would eventually come home and go to law school. Poor blacks moving up to northern cities to start their lives were not so secure. Neurotically promoting the idea of women in the military, liberals lightly instruct soldiers to learn to repress their sexuality. That's a brilliant liberal idea for better living. Train men to stop looking at women sexually. The left's ideal world is G.I. Jane showering while she chats with her Navy SEAL commander, who registers no response at the sight of a naked woman. Liberals seek to destroy sexual differentiation in order to destroy morality. The vagina monologues is the apotheosis of the left's desire to treat women's sexuality like some bovine utilitarian device, stripped of any mystery or eroticism. Another way liberals think women should be like men is in the relentless pursuit of casual sex. Of all the fictional devices used by Hollywood, the rampant promiscuity of beautiful women is the most ludicrous. But apart from the History Channel and C-SPAN, pretty much all they're doing on the lowbrow channels is fornicating. Casts of entire shows ought to have the clap by now. The real-life consequences of Hollywood behavior rarely figure into the plot lines. There's a lot of meaningless sex, but not so many abortions, venereal diseases, and bitter divorces. Another way liberals flaunt their omnipotence is by toying with murderous predators. If liberals expressed half as much self-righteous indignation about crime as they do about the random case of police brutality, one might be inclined to take them seriously. Criminals they like. It's the police they hate. In his book, The White Negro, Norman Mailer wrote, "One is hip or one is square. One is a rebel or one conforms. One is a frontiersman in the Wild West of American nightlife, or else a square cell trapped in the totalitarian tissues of American society, doomed willy-nilly to conform if one is to succeed." Liberals have reinvented the master race, and it is their own hip selves. Noticeably, more fancy, high-priced lawyers jumped at the chance to represent American trader John Walker, free of charge, than would have touched Paula Jones' case with a 10-foot pole. Predators are great fun for liberals. Criminals and poor people allow them to swell with a sense of their own incredible self-worth. That's the whole point of being a liberal. To feel superior to people with less money. They enjoy pitying unfortunate wretches and trifling with killers. Only the grasping, acquisitive middle class with their petty rules and morals are a nascent threat to liberal pomposity. Consider that the leading Democrat argument against Bush's tax cut was to demand to know how exactly it would help anyone. Scratching their heads and babbling about long-term economic goals and short-term economic goals, liberals exasperatedly asked to know how a tax cut was supposed to improve people's lives. To state the manifestly obvious, people would have more money. That's an improvement right there. Liberals are so blocked on the idea that people's money should be their own, they can't see the big fat reward. More money. It's some metaphysical thing with liberals. More money will give people more money. Isn't that the goal? What am I missing? The New York Times has transformed into a caricature of the old reactionary WASP establishment, swatting down the social-climbing middle class with their polo mallets. They are annoyed at the thought of new money emerging from the perpetual dynamism of a capitalist economy. Really vicious liberals are constantly bragging that they love paying taxes. They want their taxes to be raised even higher. The ostensible point of these boasts is to induce admiration for their deep patriotism or unbounded generosity toward the poor. But the real point is to announce that they do not share the working class's petty concern with taxes. Nothing would make liberal environmentalists so happy as an entire country that looked like the Hamptons. Beautiful rich people living in solar-powered homes staffed with a phalanx of obedient servants who can't afford SUVs. Liberals believe their fabulous wealth is a product of their unique brilliance, and the rest of us should live like aboriginals to preserve the view. Republicans are simultaneously portrayed as the swine in third class and the rich, which, on the basis of Democratic tax proposals, evidently means any guy with an alarm clock. But for the incessant mind-numbing repetition of liberal propaganda, people would recognize this as a blinding contradiction. In fact, and contrary to another liberal myth, conservatives are aggressively anti-elitist. Reagan was so beloved by working-class Americans that a new demographic had to be created in his name, Reagan Democrats. Still, leftists couldn't overcome their counterfactual stereotypes and continued to denounce Reagan as the champion of the rich. Liberal cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer said Reagan was making the world safe for white, male, heterosexual millionaires. Republicans may resent the fact that unions give so much money to Democrats, but they don't hate the worker. Who would be more likely to have a beer with a trucker, Tom DeLay or Barbara Boxer? Democrats actually hate working-class people. The preposterous conceit that Democrats are the party of the people and Republicans the party of the powerful has been repeated so often that by now it is incapable of disproof. In fact, all conceivable evidence supports the theory that liberalism is a whimsical luxury of the very rich and the very poor, both of whom have little stake in society. While the Democratic Party hauls in enormous donations from Hollywood celebrities and multimillionaire trial lawyers, the average donation to the Republicans is about $50. For years, the Republican National Committee has proudly posted the size of its average donation and tauntingly asked the Democrats to release theirs. The Democrats have doggedly refused to do so. During the 2000 campaign, a Democratic spokesman justified this refusal, saying that an abstract number representing the average donation constituted proprietary information. The most fabulously wealthy senators are invariably Democrats. After the 2000 election, for example, there were four senators worth $200 million or more, and all four were Democrats: Senator John Kerry, Senator John Corzine, Senator Herb Kohl, and Senator Jay Rockefeller. College dropout and working-class phony Michael Moore produced a documentary, Roger and Me, that was wildly popular with rich liberals who enjoyed jeering at workers from the land of the pork rinds. As a caustic review in The New Yorker summarized the point of Roger and Me, members of the audience can laugh at ordinary working people and still feel that they are taking a politically correct position. The UAW denounced Moore for the film. The left reveres Moore as an authentic blue-collar type. Only people who are grounded in a sense of their own value and who do not think the good life consists of being able to sneer at other people as inferior can resist the lure of liberal snobbery. If liberals couldn't exercise their adolescent sneers through their control of the mass media, there would be no liberals at all. It is important for liberals to demean the people they oppose to reinforce their sense of class superiority. Anyone can associate himself with the elite by adopting the left's snooty superiority and laughing at Republicans for being dumb hicks. Adopting the prejudices of powerful interests is a way of saying you are with the in-crowd. You are with the cool Hollywood types who hang out with Gwyneth Paltrow, Sean Penn, and David Geffen, not the working-class hillbillies who go to NASCAR races. It doesn't matter if you, personally, are a smelly white trash idiot who doesn't have a college degree. To be cool, all you have to do is call Republicans stupid, or some similarly brilliant riposte, express greater empathy for a tree in the Brazilian Amazon than a human fetus, State your deep affection for government-sanctioned theft and support drug legalization, sexual promiscuity, and child-molesting murderers on death row. Liberalism's leverage is not that it has broad support, but precisely that it doesn't. Who listens to NPR? Who, outside of New York City, reads the New York Times? Who claims to be frightened of George Bush? The answer? People who are desperately eager to associate themselves with respectable opinion, as opposed to actual widespread local opinion believed by the riffraff. If liberal propaganda didn't work, it would be impossible to comprehend bimbo starlets and uneducated slobs attacking the intelligence of the man who won the Cold War. On the occasion of Reagan's 90th birthday, for example, Michael Moore opined on ABC's Politically Incorrect. Personally, the problem with Reagan, as I see it, is that he was the beginning of the depleting of the political gene pool, when Americans settled for somebody who really wasn't and shouldn't have been in that office, wasn't quite there all the time. Here's what Reagan did. He gave weapons to the Ayatollah so that he could raise money for the Contras, which then helped bring a crack epidemic into the United States. That's what Ronald Reagan did, and that's his legacy. That's his legacy. To point out that Moore is a college dropout is not to adopt the classism and snobbery of the left. A lot of people who went to Southwest Texas Junior College are shrewder than Yale graduates. But try flipping around that scenario. Imagine a no-account college dropout attacking Al Gore's intelligence on national TV. The audience wouldn't get that. It would be strange and confusing. Larry Flint, who never finished grade school, said of President Bush, who was graduated from Yale College and Harvard Business School, "He's the dumbest president we have ever had." Actor Martin Sheen, who never went to college after flunking his college entrance exam, intentionally, he claims, said Bush is, quote, "a moron, if you'll pardon the expression." Strictly speaking, moron is a word, not an expression. When Reagan was president, there wasn't a college campus in the country where the mere mention of his name failed to inspire cackles of hateful laughter, except probably Hillsdale College and Bob Jones University. Now it's Bush that prompts the knowing giggles. At law schools, Rehnquist inspires the canned laughter. Liberals bully people with their veiled class bigotry. They are snobs even when championing a grade school dropout like Flint, whose self-described first sexual experience was with the egg sac of a chicken. By contrast, the attorney who prosecuted Flint for obscenity offenses, a former Marine no less, is described as dowdy and a moral crusader. So while the prosecutor who prosecutes Flint is on a crusade, Flint is a martyr. The martyr gets lots of fawning news coverage, but the tyrannical crusader is the subject of sneering attacks. Now you decide, Mr. Pedestrian Nobody. Do you laugh at how stupid Republicans are, or don't you? Do you say you're a feminist pro-choice environmentalist who is afraid of George W. Bush and laughs knowingly at Dan Quayle? Or are you one of those hicks who watches NASCAR races? There is no more pristine example of the left's in-crowd snobbery than their treatment of conservative author and activist Phyllis Schlafly. Taking on the role of disinformation commissar for the now-dead Soviet Union, the national news media maintain a rigid radio silence on Phyllis Schlafly while endlessly celebrating mediocre feminist shrews. Her very name prompts derisive hoots from Hollywood starlets who couldn't approach Schlafly's IQ if they were having brains instead of silicone injected. To listen to the cool people, you could be forgiven for thinking Schlafly is one step above a cretin. In fact, Schlafly is one of the most accomplished and influential people in America. After working her way through college, 48 hours a week in an ammunition plant test-firing machine guns, where she earned straight A's and graduated, a year early, Phi Beta Kappa and Pi Sigma Alpha, Schlafly won a scholarship to Harvard Graduate School. Though Harvard Law School did not admit women at the time, Schlafly's professors were so bowled over by her intellect they were prepared to make an exception for her. Her constitutional law professor called her brilliant and gave her an A. Her undergraduate political science professor wrote that her intellectual capacity is extraordinary and her analytical ability is distinctly remarkable. Schlafly is the most capable woman student we have had in this department in 10 years. Schlafly has written 10 books, most of them on military policy. One, an 800-page vivisection of Henry Kissinger and his policy of détente. Her first book, A Choice Not an Echo, sold 3 million copies. The average nonfiction book sells about 5,000 copies. That book led to Barry Goldwater's nomination and created the movement that eventually led to Ronald Reagan's presidency. Her military work was a major factor in Reagan's decision to proceed with high frontier technology. Most astonishing was her single-handed defeat of the Equal Rights Amendment. When Schlafly decided to take on the ERA, it was supported by every living ex-president, 90% of the U.S. Congress, almost every governor, and every major newspaper, television, network, and magazine in the nation, including 36 women's magazines with a combined circulation